Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, you're listening to The Sociology Show, a podcast about absolutely anything to do with the wonderful world of sociology. Whether you're a teacher, a lecturer, a student, or just taking a passing interest, this podcast will look at a range of issues from social class, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, religion, crime, education, and anything else that sociology has to offer. My name is Matthew Wilkin, and each episode I will speak to someone working in the field of sociology and let them explain all about their own interests, their research, and their experiences. So, put your earphones in, turn the volume up, and let's be sociology geeks together, eh?
Hi, thank you very much for coming on the Sociology Show podcast. Do you want to start by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. Well, firstly, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast. I've enjoyed listening to past episodes, so I'm really excited to be on as a participant today. My name is Chris Waugh. I am a final year doctoral researcher in sociology at the University of Manchester, and my research is about masculinity and radical left-wing groups in the UK.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you. So let's unpack that a little bit more. We hear a lot in the media about radical right-wing groups, but not necessarily about the radical left-wing. So we should probably start with some definitions as to what that actually means.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a really interesting question because I feel like terms like radical left and radical right are thrown about a lot, similarly with terms like hard left or hard right. And often they're used in a kind of pejorative sense. You know, like you saw a lot of people saying that Jeremy Corbyn, for example, was a hard left Labour leader. But we don't really often pick apart, well, what do these terms mean? The way I'm defining them is as groups that generally are sceptical about the frameworks of kind of liberal democracy. So they're quite generally sceptical about parliamentary democracy, not from the perspective that they're against democracy, but that they generally feel that that doesn't quite go far enough towards representing the needs of the people. So the groups that I'm looking at, some of them are involved in parliamentary politics. So one of my main groups is Momentum, which is a group that obviously existed to support the then leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, and now is kind of just a left faction within the Labour Party. But I also have done work with organisations that don't get involved in parliamentary politics. So groups are a little bit further to the left, such as the Socialist Workers' Party, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, and the Communist Party of Great Britain.
So would they consider themselves Marxists or neo-Marxists, perhaps?
That's an interesting question, because some of them are fairly transparently Marxist or neo-Marxist, so Communist Party, Socialist Workers' Party, etc. With Momentum, which is the main group I've kind of been working with, it's a bit of a mixed bag. They generally define their politics as being kind of the sort of the slogan that was very much associated with Corbynism, you know, a kind of fairer politics. Words like socialism appear periodically in the way they define themselves in their literature. And within that group, you will find a lot of people who are maybe Marxist, neo-Marxist, but as an organization itself, Momentum tends to shy away from using a lot of that terminology for reasons that are quite interesting. I think we'll probably end up discussing a bit later on.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned right at the top of the show, masculinity. So I'm always interested to start by asking people why the interest in that area.
Yeah, sure. So my interest in masculinities and left-wing groups began really when I was an undergraduate and I was getting involved in kind of sort of radical left-wing activism. So I was doing my degree around the time that the government was starting to bring in austerity and tripling of tuition fees. So I became involved in a lot of groups that opposed those kind of measures. And in my head, I'd always envisioned the radical left as being this space of kind of progressivism and emancipatory politics, a space where, you know, people of all races and genders could come together and work together to create a better world. And I was really shocked when I would be going to meetings and taking part in, you know, protest actions to see how much overt sexism and misogyny existed within these groups. Hmm. You mentioned earlier the radical right. I mean, we tend to associate, I think, kind of aggressive sexism with radical right-wing politics because they're generally quite hostile to kind of progressive ideas around gender. But within the left, I think it's a massive oversight. And there have been, in fact, some fairly prominent scandals around, if you like, the sexual politics of the left. So most notably, in 2013, the Socialist Workers' Party, which used to be a really major group on the left in British politics, essentially collapsed. Most of their membership quit after it emerged that the party had tried to cover up an allegation of sexual violence where a young woman had alleged that she'd been molested by a senior man in the party, right? So there's clearly a tension there. It's a tension that outside of those scandals I've witnessed in spaces where you see kind of men perhaps behaving in a way that might be quite patriarchal, kind of reaffirming, you know, the practices we might see in wider society, at the same time as defining as being feminists and trying to critique that model. So initially the interest came out of, well, to me, this is completely contradictory to what I understand about being on the left. At the same time, I think I'm also very interested in an area of research which I think I can understand why, but it's maybe a little bit overlooked, which is how men are affected by structures like patriarchy, structures like, you know, sexism and overt misogyny. How does that affect men as much as it affects women? So for me, the research started out initially as being, how do I help reform the left? And that's still a goal, but it now is kind of, well, how do I help men understand how to navigate what is often a very complex culture around these kind of movements?
That's it's an area that I'm really, really interested in as well. I think we often, you know, probably guilty of it myself when I teach about what is patriarchy, you know, an idea that it's a system designed by men for men and benefits men. And actually, you know, as you said, the evidence shows that patriarchy damages men. Patriarchy damages men as well as damaging women. And that certainly does seem to be an area that's overlooked.
Absolutely. And it's certainly something that emerged out of the research I've done. You know, I've over the course of the PhD, I've been interviewing both men and women and gender non-conforming people about kind of broadly the sexual politics of these groups. And it's really interesting, you know, on the one hand, I've heard some absolute horror stories from women about their experiences of sexism, but I've also heard, I would say, kind of slightly lesser horror stories about men who have just found themselves stuck in this situation. Like, they're trying to, you know, proactively be anti-sexist, you know, to oppose patriarchal structures. But what they tend to find is it's a lot harder to actually do that in practice than it is in theory. And often when they attempt to do something, that is actually received with quite a lot of hostility. And I guess, you know, the central idea one of the central ideas I'm really trying to get across is that it can often be, if you're the sort of man who cares about these issues, who wants to, you know, work towards women's emancipation or the emancipation of trans and non-binary people, it can often be really hard to actually do the right thing, or more importantly, to be interpreted as doing the right thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so you can get the white knight syndrome, can't you? You can be the one to be stepping in. And I know from personal experience, sometimes if you do try and stand up for certain issues, people see it as a kind of a tactic to try and attract women. You're only doing it, you know, wearing a T-shirt with "this is what a feminist looks like" is just a way to try and entrap women as well. I've even heard that sort of argument. So it's incredibly difficult to navigate.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you've hit the nail on the head there, I think, because there is, I think, this, and I've met men like this who are clearly trying to be this kind of, you know, male feminists because they want to get girls, but equally, and over the course of this research, I've met some really, you know, frankly inspiring activists who have been at the hard edge of trying to, you know, fight for women's rights and be good allies. And it has often been quite sad when I've been talking to them that I can see the kind of work they're doing and I can see the really material impact they're trying to have, but they're often getting quite a hostile response. And I'm not saying that, you know, the women need to sort of pat them on the head and call them good boys. I'm saying that there seems to be this kind of ambivalence about how you be a man on the left, right? Because there is obviously the model where you could just ignore everything and you become part of the problem. But if you're trying to do something different, then you end up in a very ambivalent, very ambiguous place where your actions could easily be interpreted or misrecognized, if we want to use the kind of, you know, borrow from Nancy Fraser's language, as prolonging the patriarchy.
That it's a really, really difficult one to navigate, as you said. It's one of the issues around that, Chris, is that there's a divide within feminism itself, in that some feminists do strongly agree that men should be feminists and they want men on their side. But there's also, you know, some feminists that say, no, feminism is a women's movement for women and men should keep out, basically. I think there's a book out recently called Feminism for Women, which argues that exact point.
Mm, absolutely, and 100%. That's definitely, there was a big divide in the women I spoke to about which of those camps they fell into. I think a lot of them did come from, you know, the kind of school of thought which I always associate with people like bell hooks, this idea that feminism is for everyone and that men and women have a role, both have roles in feminism, it's just maybe slightly different. And then women who were very much of the opinion that the most a man could be is pro-feminist rather than an actual feminist. And the thing is, I can kind of see where both groups are coming from, because I come from the perspective that men should be involved in feminism, albeit in a very different role to the way that women are. But I can understand perhaps the suspicion that comes from men inauthentically claiming this mantle of feminism in order to either sort of, well, sometimes it's about getting girls, sometimes it's about, I think, this sort of, this weird idea that maybe by, you know, that you become virtuous by the virtue of your ideas, if that makes sense. You know, oh, I'm a feminist, I can't possibly do X, Y, or Z. And it is a big divide. And equally with a lot of the men I spoke to, there was a lot of disagreement, you know, should we call ourselves feminists? Should we call ourselves allies? How does one navigate this really complex sort of problem of language and positionality? And it's interesting because on the one hand, these conversations are incredibly important, but I think, and this is one of the things I talk about in the research, what it results in is a kind of inertia, right? Mm. We often, particularly in a lot of sections of the radical left, we spend a lot of time trying to work out what the correct thing to do is, and what that often comes at the expense of is actually attracting people who are maybe not so embedded in those conversations to our movements, and then actually going out to change things.
Yeah.
You know, I think like one of my participants put this really beautifully to me. I'm paraphrasing here, so I don't think I'm going to capture his eloquence. He was saying to me that one of the problems around sort of the sexual politics of the left is that it is so complex, you basically need a PhD in sociology to understand what's going on, right? And this is a guy who, outside of activism, you know, he's a counselor for like homeless people, and he's really committed to socialists. You know, he believed firmly that, you know, the only way we're going to solve the housing crisis in this country is through socialism. But he said to me, look, Chris, I would never bring my clients to, you know, my local labor branch meeting, right? Because I'd be telling them that this is a space where there's going to be people who want them safely fed, safely housed, all of this stuff. And then we go into the meeting and people would be having these weird academic arguments about minor turns of phrase, or they'd be expecting people to know everything about this particular theory and that particular theory. And that is so alienating to your average person on the street whose big concern is, when am I going to get paid? Am I going to be able to eat? Am I going to be able to put the bills on? You know, the way he phrased it was, sometimes you look at left-wing spaces and you can understand why people would become Tories, right? Just because they can be extraordinarily inaccessible because of these complexities.
Yeah, I mean, a rather mundane example, but a friend of mine who is, I would say, slightly right of centre, said, you know, for him, Corbyn lost them when he was concerned about announcing his pronouns. And they were like, we're not talking about that. What we're bothered about is, can I afford to put a meal on the table and pay my electricity bill? So I can see what you're saying there in terms of where it can be lost.
Absolutely. And the thing is, I think perhaps one of the problems with the Left as a whole is trying to make the argument that those are both part of the same emancipatory project. You know, yeah, we want to make sure we live in a world where everyone can express themselves however they feel most comfortable, if that's pronouns, then sure thing. But also, we can't just dwell on that. We need to dwell on the practical projects, which are, you know, as you say, how are we going to put food on the table? How are we going to survive the winter with this so-called cost of living crisis? And I think, you know, what really struck me is that I think for me, particularly, you know, it's a complex environment for people of all genders, I think, within the left. But I think for men, because they often, the way I've described it is that left-wing masculinity can be described as a kind of inarticulate masculinity. So it's a form of masculinity where you might really understand the very compelling arguments as to men's role in patriarchy, you know, how men perpetuate it in private and public spaces, and you're desperately wanting to try and change that. But when it comes down to the practical suggestion, the steps, like what do you actually do, it becomes difficult, right? And that's partly because sometimes you get a lot of hostility for speaking up or not speaking up. But also it comes down to a question of, really it comes down to the question of when do you speak and when do you not? So many of my participants told me about cases where, you know, they tried to stand up when, you know, say a female comrade or something was experiencing sexism. And then they'd be criticized afterwards for trying to speak over them. So it's kind of it's a sort of weird damned if you do, damned if you don't. And the way I understand this is, you know, if we remember our Foucault, he said that there's many different types of silences, right? And I think often when men engage in a process I call active silence, which is a process where they say, okay, I'm going to shut up. I'm going to let you speak. I'm going to give you the floor. You use that space. That active silence is sometimes taken to be a passive silence, a silence of I don't care, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. It does. Because it's sort of going the other way, I really hate the term sort of virtual signaling, being woke and so on. But I think, I don't know if I'm putting this right, but sometimes the activism or the want to do the right thing can look forced. You know, for example, sometimes classed as tokenism or using a female pundit on a football match or something like that. But yeah. I think that's what leads a lot of people rolling their eyes when they feel like it's a tick box exercise that's forced as opposed to genuine.
Absolutely. And the idea of what is and is not authentic really came out in the interviews I had with people across the sort of gender spectrum. Because you're right, it can sometimes, I think, seem very forced. It can seem like it's, you know, and I don't like using this kind of terminology because I feel there's a more eloquent way of expressing it, but it's like diversity for the sake of diversity. Yeah. You know, I think there's an extent to which, and this is something that maybe doesn't come out of left theory as much as about the culture around these movements, that we are so concerned with correctness, you know, we're so concerned with doing that right thing that we often forget that, you know, sometimes learning how to do the right thing is a really messy process. Mm-hmm. You know, people will get it wrong. People will, you know, they might make mistakes with pronouns or they might say something that they didn't really think through. And that's fine. We're all, you know, ideally, we're all meant to be eternal students. We're all meant to be learning and developing. But there's something I think that maybe limits a certain degree of left-wing culture when we do become obsessed with this kind of question of correctness, which has its own interesting history, which you could connect to, you know, like the Leninist left and the very dogmatic idea of what truth is. But I think, you know, to people outside of these movements, you're right, it kind of might seem inauthentic. It might seem like, well, as to go back to your example, like, why are you talking about pronouns? I can't put food on the table.
The Sociology Show podcast relies on the kind contributions of sponsorship and donations. If you enjoy the show, then you can help with the hosting costs by donating as little as £5 on the GoFundMe page. Simply visit uk.gofundme.com and search for The Sociology Show. If you can donate, then you will be sent a Sociology Show pen as a small thank you for your continued support of the show.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's something else that I'm really interested in, Chris, is we mentioned right early on in the show that patriarchy obviously does damage huge numbers of people, men and women. One of the things that concerns me is that a lot of men feel that they do suffer themselves, you know, that they perhaps are a victim of something, or they experience some form of gender inequality, or that, you know, there are disadvantages that men face. And when those are raised, that often gets a negative reaction as well. If someone, a man, were to raise their hand in a gender equality talk and said, what about men, that sort of thing, that's often quashed and put down as well. And that's something that worries me, because I think men do face disadvantages disadvantages in society. And if they're not given spaces to express those as well, that's got to be damaging for everyone too.
Oh, 100%. I'm with you on that. And I've been in those meetings where, you know, a man has raised often a very valid concern about inequalities or forms of oppression that generally affect men. And it's taken in bad faith rather than being that genuine concern. Because, yeah, you know, there are issues under patriarchy. You know, we only need to think about things like, you know, high rates of male suicide, you know, men being more less likely to be able to, for example, gain custody of their children in disputes and so on and so forth. And I think the issue here for me is that I think to an extent the right has done a brilliant job of co-opting men's issues into their worldview, whereas the left doesn't, or at least has been very bad at creating a framework for thinking about, well, how do men's inequalities fit into socialism, essentially. And it's interesting you bring this point up, because one of the, you know, there's not a huge amount of research about masculinities on the left, which is one of the other things that attracted me to it. But a lot of the work that has been done came out of men involved in socialist movements trying to answer these questions themselves. So, for example, between the late 1970s and early 1990s, there were a bunch of men's socialist magazines, right? The most famous of which was called Achilles Heel. It was written by a bunch of men, mainly in London, who were mainly affiliated with the Labour Party. Many of them had experiences of working in mental health services. And what they basically did was they set themselves a task of saying, okay, we support what women are doing, we support feminism, but we know that there are things that affect men and boys, right? How do we come up with a framework that fits the values of feminism, the values of socialism, that also addresses these issues, right? And if you go to the archives and you read these magazines, they're so profound. You know, they're talking about fatherhood and male mental health and, you know, how you navigate intimate relationships. You know, how do you talk about sex in a way that doesn't objectify women but still allows you to, you know, chat to your mates about sex and stuff? And this is all written by a bunch of, you know, trade unionists in the 80s. And it is fascinating reading. But then you look at the history of these movements and they just died in the 90s. You know, they got to the point where, for various reasons, they just fizzled out. And I think because those conversations weren't sustained, because those didn't become an intimate part of the culture around left movements, that's where we get those situations where men, when they are trying to genuinely call attention to very real inequalities, very real oppression that men face, there is no framework for thinking about that apart from, you know, their perception that they're taking the mickey, right? And I think that drives a lot of men away from those spaces. And then you've got the right with open arms saying, oh, yes, we're the ones who are talking about these issues, even if their answers are, I would argue, at least are not going to actually address the problems. So, yes, definitely an issue there.
That's interesting. You said that they sort of gained momentum in the 80s. And then I wonder if that was stopped in the 90s is sort of affiliated with the new lad, you know, booze, bird, football. I wonder if that was a complete sort of antithesis of what it was trying to achieve.
I think there's an element to that because, yeah, you know, the 90s, you get this alternative kind of rebellious model of masculinity, as you say, the kind of new lad and stuff, which fits in with kind of, you know, the boom era, the neoliberal ideology that was starting to really kind of become prevalent at that point. And maybe that the movements that were trying to build around these magazines just couldn't keep up with those developments. I mean, it's in the history of those magazines in themselves are fascinating, and I could talk for ages about them because I think there's something that a lot of the left doesn't even remember as a part of our history. But the way that the editorial board behind those groups sort of rationalized it was what wore them down was firstly being unable to come up with definitive answers. So there would often be these fascinating discussions and debates about, you know, how socialist men navigate these issues, but they couldn't come up with a simple, like, straightforward, here's a step-by-step guide. There was also sometimes quite a lot of hostility from feminist movements towards them, and they took it in good faith. They sort of said, yeah, we get why you're maybe a bit worried about what we're trying to do, but we want to engage with you. And I think also it came, you know, it came down, it is also really connected to the, you know, the crushing of organized labor under Thatcher. You know, by the early 1990s, the left in this country was pretty much in disarray, as I would argue it is today.
Yeah.
And so there isn't the appetite to keep those discussions going. But I really hope if my research accomplishes anything in terms of like a public sociology is to try and get those discussions going. Because I think, you know, you read these articles from the 70s and 80s and they are so applicable to the things that I've struggled with, to the things that I know a lot of men on the left have struggled with, that we need to have that framework. Otherwise, we are just going to end up in this uncomfortable situation where we feel like we're there in this ambivalent, horrible place in left-wing culture, rather than, you know, working together with our female comrades, our non-binary comrades to end the problems that we actually face.
Mm. And just going back to what I was saying, my concern to do with that, Chris, how do you think men on the left, how do we raise those issues? Because, you know, if there is a discussion about pushing feminism, pushing gender equality, I would say it takes a brave man to put the hand up and say, what about us? So how can we do it?
It's a really good question. And I think reflecting on what Achilles Heel did back in the day and also reflecting on the discussions I have with my participants, I think it is about often... And this is going to sound, I imagine, silly, but bear with me. I think it is about developing safe spaces for men. Mm. Now, immediately, I can tell there's probably going to be some people who listen to this podcast and think that's ridiculous. Safe spaces are, you know, for people who are oppressed by in a dominant culture, not for people who are part of that oppression. But bear with me. What I mean, when I say safe spaces, I imagine them as, you know, places where people can withdraw, have a think about the issues that affect them as a group, and then go back out into the wider world with a new language and a new framework. So to my mind, that's things like getting men together to discuss things in a kind of consciousness-raising session. So yeah, you're right. It takes a very brave man to put up their hand in a meeting on gender inequality and say, what about the men? But if a bunch of men have gone away and thought of a really clear, coherent argument, then it becomes perhaps a little bit less scary to raise those questions. Now, I fully accept that that's a model that people have tried and hasn't always worked. But I think I can't really see a way that we're going to progress unless men are really sitting down and having these conversations with other men on their own in a space where they feel comfortable and building up kind of tools that they can then take into those bigger, perhaps more contentious meetings and say, look, I want to talk about how this affects men with full respect to what you guys are going through, because I want to have common ground. I want us to understand that I experience this oppression too, without that diverting attention from what you experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I was speaking to an American academic recently who she mentioned that she thought it's quite a pivotal moment what's happened with the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case. Because for the first time, many people are saying, hang on a minute, let's listen to the voice, you know, that a man can be a victim, that he can be attacked.
Oh, yeah.
And she was saying just how groundbreaking she thought that has been because of the amount of coverage and press that it's received.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know there was a lot of very kind of tasteless conversations around the whole case, particularly on social media. But at its core, I think if we can take something relatively positive from that, is that it has drawn attention to the fact that men can be victims of domestic violence, in particular, and emotional abuse. The way we, you know, outside of academia, I've spent a long time working as a support worker with domestic abuse survivors, and it is obviously it's terrible for anyone of any gender, but some of the clients I've found in the most difficult support have been the men, because we have such a gendered understanding of vulnerability, such a gendered understanding of risk. And at least with, you know, the Amber Heard case, there seems to be a sort of a slight paradigm shift in this, what men can be vulnerable to.
I agree. Yeah. I was chatting to someone else who's got both a son and a daughter, and they said they're obviously, they're concerned about their sons and daughters' futures for perhaps different reasons. You know, if you're talking about the threat or fear of sexual harassment and so on, obviously it's on the daughter, but you know, it's interesting what they were picking out in terms of fears for their son, failing education, you know, more likely to perhaps be suicidal, perhaps concerns about the job labor market for the future. And so I wonder if, you know, both can experience problems, but they're different problems, if that makes sense. You know, there's sort of idiosyncrasies between the sort of problems that males may face compared to what women may face in the future.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I would see them as, you know, broadly to my mind, you know, as I said, I'm coming from a kind of socialist framework. I see a lot of those problems as being a product of things like capitalism. And you mentioned this, we talked about suicidality. You don't have to look too deeply to see how mental health services have been gutted by austerity as well as other kind of, you know, cost-saving measures. But yes, I think one of the big questions, I think, in a lot of left-wing sort of ideas is, how do you balance equality and difference? Because we all want equality, right? We want to have that kind of parity. But I think we need to also acknowledge that there is a difference. As you say, you know, with the person you were talking about, there's the fear, well, what is the issues that my daughter is going to face are going to be different from the issues that my son is going to face, but we can perhaps see those issues as part of a whole social structure that ultimately needs to be abolished. But in the meantime, we have to acknowledge those differences and tackle them perhaps separately as part of a broader struggle.
I don't know if you've encountered this, Chris, but often when I've discussed this, an argument that's often fired back is the problems that men experience are of their own making. You know, if you look at, for example, if you raise the fact that men are actually more likely to be attacked than women in the street, the argument is yes, by other men. Men are more likely to face homelessness or suicide, the argument, yes, because they've done it to themselves. And slightly unsympathetic, I would say. But have you encountered that yourself?
Oh, yeah. No, I have. And it's, again, it's an argument where I try and be sympathetic to why people might believe that. And I try to take the view that maybe they're trying to make a point about men's complicity in patriarchy, but I also think it's a very unhelpful argument. I think it's deeply stigmatizing, and particularly when we're talking about things like, you know, homelessness or being a victim of crime, it's totally unhelpful, isn't it? You know, like, I think sometimes it's a case of the points that you might make in, say, a gender studies seminar are not the points you would make to a homeless bloke on the street, you know, if you were trying to help him, right? But I think, to me, I would take the view that if someone, and people have said that argument to me, I'd say, okay, well, I get why you think like that, but where do we go from here? You've made that case clear. What's the way forward in your mind, right? So what steps are men supposed to take, right? And I think this is, you know, and I do, you know, I think this is something that it did sort of slightly frustrate me in some of the research that I did, which was, so I'll give you a specific example. So a lot of the women I spoke to would often tell me that they perceived a lot of the older men in their movements as being these kind of old misogynistic dinosaurs, right? You know, it was old white men who were the problem. And let's face it, you know, a lot of old white men are quite sexist. But then I would speak to kind of these older blokes, and, you know, we're talking like blokes who are in their sort of 60s and 70s, you know, they've been trade unionists for decades. And they were some of the most devoted allies I'd ever spoken to. Like, I was genuinely, I remember speaking to one guy who dedicated his life to, or at least a big chunk of his life to, you know, he'd worked in various educational settings, and his big thing was, how do I make my classes trans inclusive? And he'd been doing that long before I think a lot of people were talking about trans issues, right? And I think that whole idea of, oh, you know, kind of older men are sort of these misogynistic dinosaurs, it's like, okay, some of them are, but where do we go from there? In the same way that when people say, oh, men are responsible for, have sort of brought it on themselves, that they're victims of crime or homelessness, it's kind of like, and well, where do we go from that? Like, that's me, that's not a particularly helpful way to think about it. And it also, it misrecognizes, I think, a lot of elements of the problem.
So where do you sit at the moment, Chris, as you know, a man on the left that is passionate about gender equality? Where are you at the moment in terms of what you should say, shouldn't say, sit back in silence, join in? Where are you?
That's a really good question. And it's something I, you know, the last chapter, I've just finished writing my last empirical chapter of my research, and that's something I tried to wrap my head around. I think, to me, it comes down to, I will speak when I feel like I can, but I will also try and use silence strategically when I think it's helpful. So I'm a big believer in active silence, kind of letting people say their piece, get off their chest, and then trying to be guided by that. But also, you know, it is a frustrating situation because, you know, every single person that I've spoken to, and I interviewed about 30 people over a year's period, you know, it was slightly ironic. I planned this whole ethnography and then obviously lockdown happened, so it was mostly done over Zoom. But, you know, I spoke to sort of 30 people over the course of a year, and all of them, I think, had shared the same common concerns, which is how are we going to survive the winter? How are we going to get rid of this government? How are we going to make our lives better? But at the same time, there is this kind of this frustrating sense in which there's no clear answer right now. So like some of the men I spoke to offered different strategies. So being actively silent and listening, which is the thing that maybe I fall into. Some of them tried to suggest that maybe we need to renounce masculinity in its entirety. And I can understand some of those arguments, so I don't necessarily agree. But as I wrote in what's probably going to be the final chapter of my thesis, I think what's come out of the research isn't really a solution, more as sharpening the lens through which we can see the problem exists. And really, we need to think more about dealing with this, because I can't see the left ever making any palpable change unless it deals with these issues. And we've talked about gender. There's, I would say, a similar issue about ethnicity. I think we could talk about issues around sexuality, and ability. You know, if we are sat here, to go back to what my participant said, if we're sat here making all of this very, very complicated, we're not changing anyone's lives for the better, are we? How we go about doing that, I'm still trying to work it out, but we need to do something.
Yeah, I think even if it's highlighting it without the solutions, I think that's a very good starting point.
Yeah.
Chris, just aware of time, I always ask people to finish by giving out some details if people want to add you on Twitter or find out more about your work.
Yeah, sure. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @classwaugh. So @class and then my surname, W-A-U-G-H. I am an infrequent tweeter, but I'm going to be tweeting a little bit more about the research because I'm going to be launching a website which has some of the findings on it. Hopefully that will be a good resource for people who are interested in the left or interested in gender politics of the left. I'm also contactable via the University of Manchester. I'm always very happy to talk to people who are interested. My email address is chris.waugh-2@manchester.ac.uk. And as I said, if you follow me on social media, when I launch my website, which is going to have some tools and strategies that I've developed as part of the research, I'd be really great. It'd be great for people to have a look, give me feedback, and let me know if they're the sort of things that you might find useful taking to your activist meeting if you're involved in the left.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today, Chris. I really, really do appreciate it. And I think a follow-up interview would be good as well at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be more than happy to. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The Sociology Show podcast relies on the kind contributions of sponsorship and donations. If you enjoy the show, then you can help with the hosting costs by donating as little as £5 on the GoFundMe page. Simply visit uk.gofundme.com and search for The Sociology Show. If you can donate, then you will be sent a Sociology Show pen as a small thank you for your continued support of the show.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you would like to contact the show or be interviewed, then please email thesociologyshowpodcast@gmail.com.